Hello, fellow foodies, and welcome back. This is Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you're listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious. Today on the show, we're going to revisit one of my favorite topics, and that is the topic of crop wild relatives and the diversity of crops, not only in the farm, but also out in the wild. Our guest today is Nan McCary. She is an ethnobotanist specializing in the history of crop plants and their wild relatives. Nan's fascination with agriculture began during her upbringing working on a farm in Virginia. And these early experiences eventually became the guiding force behind her graduate studies in geography at the University of Texas, leading her to do research for her thesis on traditional home gardens in Guatemala. In the following years, Nan has balanced family life with further coursework in botany and genetics and working with local conservation nonprofits. As a volunteer at the herbarium of the Smithsonian Museum, she helped to prepare herbarium samples for studies in phylogenetics, unraveling where species fall on the evolutionary tree. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Nan. It's great to see you, and I'm excited for you to share some stories about these really fascinating crop wild relatives.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah. Why don't we start with just a definition? Tell us, what are crop wild relatives? I know some of the listeners on the show may be very familiar, but I'm sure many are not. So maybe we can just start there.
Sure. So crop wild relatives are simply the wild plants or the weedy plants that are relatives of our crops. And they hold the genetic diversity that breeders need and have always needed to both improve our crops and to make them sustainable in the face of things like climate change and pest and pathogen attacks and all of that. So really important for food security and agriculture.
Awesome. So what are some of the types of challenges to our existing crops? You mentioned climate change. Can you be a little bit more specific? What are some of the threats that our crops currently face?
Any of us who garden are aware that there are always pests in a garden. There's always challenges to anytime we try to grow plants, especially if we're growing plants that, you know, are not naturally found in that area and that are tender and that we're really trying to get some fruits or other food from. So over time, we've always had, of course, assaults on our crops. This is not really a modern thing, but it's probably worse with monoculture and the modern industrial food systems, of course, because we grow all of one thing in a field. And I think that your listeners probably know that means we had in the 1970s, there was a corn blight in the Southeast, and so much of the corn was the same, basically, clone of all of the others that, you know, from the same seeds, that it just wiped out large portions of the crop. So this is the kind of thing we have to worry about going forward. And there's other great stories of this. So our crops are fungal pathogens, always want to attack them. Of course, we know the bugs want to eat them, some of our crop pests. And then there's cold and drought and heat and salinity, all of the things that can happen to an organism.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the key here is having a diverse toolkit, right? That you can interbreed different related species or species that have favorable traits to make our food system more resilient.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Can I say something about that word resilient? I gave a talk last week at our state arboretum in Virginia on this topic, and I was just really thinking about it at the time when I put this particular slide in, and it was showing, I'll talk about phylloxera in a minute, but it was just showing how phylloxera attacks the roots of the wine grape and how we have phylloxera in American grapes, but it attacks the leaf and it doesn't kill the plant. And I was just thinking about how for resilience, we don't have to wipe out, it's impossible to completely wipe out pathogens, right? You work in the field where you work on pathogens and you can't completely wipe them out. The best thing you can do is to build the resilience so that maybe the crop doesn't completely die. So I just wanted to throw that in.
No, I love it. It's all about balance, whether you're talking about the human body or the planetary body, right? Mm-hmm. It's about finding this balance for our crops. I think that a great place to start would be some classic examples of how a lack in crop diversity can lead to devastating consequences for the food system. And one of those crises that I think every school child has read about is the Great Irish Potato Famine. Mm-hmm. Can you share with us just the story from the perspective of plant biodiversity and what happened and how might we prevent something like that happening again in the future?
As I understand it, everything, all the potatoes were of the same clone. And again, as gardeners, we know that you cut up a potato into seed potatoes. They're all identical. Now, we are told that there were other factors that made the potato famine even worse than it had to be from a biological standpoint in terms of political factors going on. But yeah, from the biological standpoint, when you have everything absolutely the same out there, and then you have a pathogen, which is perhaps a very minor pathogen in the places where the potato came from, but if it takes off there and the conditions are right, then it just kills most of the potatoes there. And of course, we know a lot of Irish people died and a lot migrated to this country, and it was devastating, apparently.
Yeah, and we've seen this repeat with other crops. I'm thinking in particular of what's happening right now with bananas. Again, yeah. Another example of a clonally propagated, meaning there's no genetic diversity. They're all exactly the same. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of fungal pathogen that attacks these bananas. They flop over.
Yeah.
And as an herb. And it's a tremendously bad situation economically for banana growers right now, because once this fungus gets in the soil, it's very difficult to, you
right.
really can't eradicate it. Those crops are going to continue to fail. And so we've seen this happen over and over again. There's got to be this balance between the need for conformity and scale up production of crops versus how do we ensure resilience? How do we ensure that we've got something that's going to stand the test against drought or pathogens, et cetera? So maybe tell us some more stories of your work with crop wild relatives and how are they even identified? Like, how would I find a crop wild relative of an important crop?
Yeah, so it's fun because I have a hobby of being excited when I find crop wild relatives anywhere. And I've been aware of this topic for a long time, but really now focusing on stuff that's in my yard that's weeds, that's a crop wild relative. Sometimes that's going to be like a Eurasian weed. I work in a native plant nursery and we have a lot of crop wild relatives there. And I'm going to work this year on starting a program of educating people about that. Kind of one more reason to put this plant in, right? This, your persimmon tree or Chickasaw plum is not going to save the world, but why not put it in your yard? And the native plant movement, at least in my part of the country, has been really successful in connecting people to nature and connecting them to the idea of that the caterpillars need to eat the leaves of the plants. And so people flock to our nursery now to buy these plants for this reason. So I just want to expand that education and awareness of, did you know these are also important crop wild relatives to the crops that you enjoy eating? And Ken, I'd love to talk about grapes a little bit, if that would be okay.
I would love it. Yeah.
Okay.
Grapes are a great crop.
So I went down a rabbit hole of grapes. It actually started at the Society for Economic Botany conference. I went to hear someone speak, Anne Francis, and she was excited about crop wild relatives. I know that you know her. And I went to her and I said, I want to work on this topic. And they had been wanting to do something on the North American relatives of the wine grape. So the wine grape is one species. And even though we think there might be lots of diversity in there, because we know thousands and thousands of cultivars, everybody's got their wines they like, right? And they all have different names. But those are all cultivars of the one wine grape. Almost all of them are Vitis vinifera is the name of the grape. And of course, that's a Eurasian grape. And there's a lot of interesting things about the grape and the need for the Native North American relatives. So there's about 60 or 70 grape species worldwide. And of course, we have the one domesticate that comes from Eurasia, they think there were two domestications of it, Georgia and also the Eastern Mediterranean. But then there's these native grapes, and we were focused on the 25 or so that are in North America. Some of these are going to be like weeds you could find in your backyard. And they're all over the country, and some are more important crop wild relatives than others. This was an effort to bring together experts on the grape. We brought them together to the Oak Spring Garden Foundation in Upperville, Virginia, to discuss the native grapes of North America, specifically as crop wild relatives. And this work was organized by U.S. Botanic Garden, NatureServe, and the USDA, and of course took place at Oak Spring. And of course, NatureServe does assessments, as you're probably aware, of how well crops are doing, how well wild species are doing. And one of the many things that this workshop was designed for was to do assessments of these, considering, of course, their importance as wild plants in their own right, but also considering their importance to agriculture, what we call their economic importance. And the classic story, the first use of crop wild relatives to save an industry was probably during the phylloxera epidemic, which was in the late 1800s in Europe. And as your listeners may know, the European wine industry was almost completely wiped out. It was a huge economic crisis for Europe and, of course, almost lost this very important crop. And this was because of phylloxera, which is a little aphid-like insect. And as I was saying, the phylloxera got into the roots of this Vitis vinifera, the European wine grape. And eventually the answer was found by grafting native rootstock, native to North America, onto the European wine grape. So there's no getting rid of the phylloxera. You have to figure out how to resist it. Now, the thing is, till this day, when people drink wine, and people might very specifically like their cultivar of wine, the varietal, right? I don't know if they think about the fact that that's only the scion. That's only the top part of your vine. The bottom part is rootstock, which has been grafted. And that rootstock comes from usually about three North American species, one of which at least is in a vulnerable status. So for no other reason, people who like wine might want to think about the importance of crop wild relatives and conserving. And we never know what genetic diversity is out there because it hasn't all been cataloged and looked at. We have to save as much of the genetic diversity as possible for these reasons.
That's great. So what you're saying then is really like my good Italian wines are part American.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the funny thing. Like even in Europe now, they're growing them on the rootstock. Now, phylloxera came from the Americas. So they can also, I know
name
that
us these, the problem.
Yes, exactly. And this is because of the exchange of plant material, which botanists and vintners have enjoyed doing so much. But I actually read something interesting last week that I hadn't thought of before, which was, it said when the steamship came along, some new technology, the vines were getting there faster. Uh-huh. So the phylloxera stayed alive. I'd never thought about that. I don't remember where I read that, but I thought that was a fascinating, you know, this, you never know all these little complex reasons for things happening, but
yeah. No, it's fascinating. When the USDA was even first being formed and they started thinking about like quarantine procedures for moving things, before it was a lot of materials going from the Americas into Europe and into Asia. And then we had movement the other way too. There's a great book on this, and I've interviewed him previously on an earlier episode of the podcast. It's called The Food Explorer by Daniel Stone. And he talks about some of these challenges of moving plant materials around and like the risk of spreading disease through these plant pathogens. And part of the reason that crop diversity is so celebrated, even if you look at the mango, there are so many versions of the mango.
Yeah.
Right? It's like there's so many different sizes and flavors and firmness and pulpiness or fiber within these. So I think that's one of the things that makes food so incredibly beautiful is that diversity. If I was stuck with eating nothing but, for example, red delicious apples, and that's the only type of apple I could ever have in my life, that would be pretty boring, right?
Right. Yeah. It's interesting you should say that because I was talking to somebody recently at the Desert Botanic Garden and talking about the raising awareness in the public for the importance of genetic biodiversity for our crops. And she said, I'm not sure people are responding so much to the word biodiversity. I think what they respond to is the narrowness of our diets. And that's perhaps in the news a lot now. And I really think you're onto something in terms of, I'm trying to figure out how to incorporate that more into my talks of, we want to have as much diversity available. And that kind of gets into the heirlooms, which people are familiar with.
Yes.
All the different mm-hmm. heirloom crops, which I think people who go to farmers markets or people who are gardeners may already be aware of the importance of heirlooms. So I'm trying to use that as saying, this is our within crop diversity, probably the same species as the crop, but now this is the crop wild relatives is the next circle out in my mind.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of thinking about it. In my classes on food, I try to showcase that inside the species diversity. It's incredible how shocking it is for students when I'll pull out a bunch of different examples of Brassica oleracea. So I'll have cauliflower, broccoli, kale, red cabbage, green cabbage, all these different members. They're all of the same species, right?
Yeah.
We have these varieties. I'm like, this is all from the same progenitor. And so there's just, yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. It's incredible to see the diversity that humans have been able to create through selective selection and breeding over time. And when you think about crop wild relatives, these are those species that maybe aren't necessarily in the diet yet, or perhaps aren't suited for the diet, but do hold, like you said, genetic information that could help defend a crop against pests that perhaps we haven't even encountered yet. That's the big thing, right? You don't know what's out next. With new pathogens emerging from the glaciers, it's like, what's hidden beneath the ice that's going to be the next thing to attack some of our favorite foods? And how do we breed our plants to be more resistant to that? Or how do we help our plants to be more drought tolerant or more salinity tolerant? Yeah. I understand all of this from a theoretical perspective. I'm not a very good horticulturalist. I keep a very modest garden I try and keep alive, but I'm certainly no plant breeder. One question I have for you, because I know this is something you're so passionate about, is community education and getting the public excited. And mm-hmm. I know you're very involved in gardening and local networks within your state, within your community. What are some of the things that have worked for you in raising awareness and excitement around diversity of our crops and biodiversity at large?
Before I say that, I want to say I am not a great gardener. I do a lot of gardening. I don't have a particularly green thumb, and I have a certain amount of impatience and many other things. So I always look up to you as one of my gardening gurus. But anyway, yeah, I've done community education for a while. For a while, I was teaching about sustainable landscaping just because that kind of grew out of the native plant movement. But I wanted people to think about the soil and the water aspects, which I don't think we were talking about. And then I got drawn into the native plant movement. So that's been a really good jumping off point for me because, again, people are interested in that. And I think that's a group that we could now reach out to and say, here's some plants like we have, like sunflowers. The sunflower is one of the crops that was actually domesticated in the area that's the United States now, and there's not too many of them. And of course, we have a lot of sunflower relatives across the United States, and we sell several in our nursery. And who doesn't love sunflowers, right? I think that that's a plant where it's charismatic. And it's just a great way to bring people in. And there's one apparently that grows out west that's particularly noted for salinity tolerance. These very specific things that these different wild relatives carry the genes for. And of course, I want to focus on ones that are native to this general area. Yeah, did I answer that question?
Yeah, I think you did. It's the focus on native plants. I don't know if you've ever read any of his work. I recently met Doug Tallamy.
Yeah.
He's written some incredible
yes.
around, which I love. I love that they're so easy to understand. And how can you, on a small scale in your own garden, increase biodiversity?
Yeah.
And there's this organization called Homegrown National Park.
Yeah.
And so if for those that are listening out there and you have a little plot of land, even if it's like a tenth of an acre, there's a lot that you can do with that tenth of an acre to plant native plants and reduce your amount of lawn footprint, because it all contributes to biodiversity and kind of the food web. It was, I learned a lot just hearing him speak about how certain native plants are host plants for caterpillars. And our birds, when they're baby birds, can't eat bird seed. They need caterpillars.
Right. So you're
feeding the birds, and then other animals come into the web. And it's just this beautiful holistic cycle that, again, also I think supports our foods.
Yeah.
And our, not only our wild foods, but also our cultivated crops.
I'm glad you brought him up, because I think he's a model for the kind of communication that I think has just been so effective, because I've just seen it in my own region, that he takes a somewhat complicated concept. Nobody wants to be eaten, he says. So plants make toxins. And then over evolutionary time, you adapt, different caterpillars adapt to the leaves. And that's really a window for people into this whole world. And he comes across also with such humility and humor that I think he's just a great ambassador for that whole movement. Yeah.
Well, I like how empowering the message is, because we talk a lot about this on the show, the challenges of climate change, the challenges of monoculture, kind of the agro-industrial complex and all the woes that it brings. And I'll be honest, there are times when I just feel like, wow, this is really depressing and it's demotivating, because I'm like, what can we do?
Right.
And I like those types of messages, because he takes something like so complex that you can then like, oh, I can make a difference. I can increase biodiversity in my community, in my neighborhood, through my work, even in my own yard or with community organizations. If you don't have a yard, what can you do to advocate for leaving species diversity in areas of land that aren't being really touched, like where all those power lines go, right? How do we keep those from being mowed so that you can have more wildflowers and grassland restoration happen? So it gave me a lot of hope. And I think it's important to have hope when we're thinking about food and health and where we can go. And Crop Wild Relatives are all about hope, right?
Yeah.
It's all about that. Now, tell me, I know you've done some work in traveling to help document and collect Crop Wild Relatives. Are there any stories you want to share from some of those experiences? What is it like to actually go out and find and document these?
I got to go on a wonderful trip, and it was actually to look at land races of potato. So that's the within crop diversity we were talking about, a little bit closer to heirlooms than, So land race just means as a cultivar that has been kept by in a small region by a family or by a community for a long time, because it's very closely adapted. And the potato is from the Andes, was domesticated there. As you've probably heard, they have like thousands of kinds of potatoes. So actually, we have a mutual acquaintance, Colin Corey, and I was working on some things that he was working on, and he's a very nice guy. And I asked, can I volunteer on this, to go on this trip with you and this team? And it was an amazing thing. We got to go up into the Andes up to 13,000 feet and into a little community. Yeah. And we didn't do the work. I was an observer, completely grateful to be there. But the project was for local bilingual people who spoke Quechua and Spanish to interview the farmers in Quechua about how much they were maintaining the land race diversity, like how many of these varieties did they still maintain in their gardens and farms, and how many had they let go over time, and maybe they had taken up a more modern cultivar, which we want that to be available to people too. And it was really exciting to just learn from them and see the amazingly differently shaped and colored potatoes and the different kinds of uses they have for the potatoes. And then the pride with which I would say most of the people who have really kept a lot of the potato land races, they call them guardians. And they take a lot of pride, because it's my grandfather cultivated this potato, and this is potato's been with us for a long time. So there's that cultural connection to maintaining the potato. Yeah, that was just, again, I was just a hanger-on on that expedition, but extremely grateful to be there.
That's great. I like the name of a guardian of diversity. That's so true. It's incredible when we think about how many crops are hanging on there, because there are people that care about specific lineages of these crops because they've been in their family and something they're saving. And it's just incredible. It's a testament to the actions of how actions of a few can really help us all as a human race.
Right.
I think that's really incredible.
At the same time, we want them to have the same access to improved cultivar. Sort of difficult thing, that it has to be a voluntary thing to maintain the cultivars.
Yeah. Absolutely. When I think about some of our biggest at-risk crops, and please, if I'm missing any, you jump in as well after this, but I'm thinking in particular of some of the challenges we're facing with bananas, already mentioned, mm-hmm. chocolate, coffee.
I know.
Citrus. These are not minor fringe crops. These are crops that many of us, I think, have taken for granted and may not be very aware of the fact that some of them are at risk because of a lack of genetic diversity in many of our large cultivars, large scale cultivars. Lots of work to do in this field, lots that we can do at home, right? Mm-hmm. Within our own gardening, increasing diversity in our own environments. Yeah. Any other takeaways on crop wild relatives or any messages you'd like to leave as we wrap up?
I just want to say about the banana, somebody has probably said this on your podcast before, but we're already on our second banana as a major world crop. And there are apparently people out there, I'm told, who say bananas just don't taste the way they used to. And they're not wrong, because that was the Gros Michel banana. And now mm-hmm. we have the Cavendish. And yeah, so we've already had to do this once, go back to the drawing board. And that's where we want to have all those amazing, wild plants available that hopefully have enough genetic diversity to get us through.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Exactly. And preserve not only, I guess, the nutritional value, but also the flavor and all the incredible characteristics of plants that we so enjoy. Thank you so much, Nan, for coming on the show. It was really great to talk with you and learn more about some of the work you're doing in crop wild relatives.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious. You can find out more about this episode and others on foodiepharmacology.com. We've also got fun links to really cool looking swag. You can pick up a coffee mug or your next grocery bag tote, all on the site. If you want to see the video version of the show, you've also got the link there. It'll take you over to the Teach Ethnobotany YouTube channel, where we have the video version of this and all of our other recent episodes. I want to thank our producers, to Rob Cohen and Christine Roth, for putting on a great show each and every week. And if you're a fan of the show, if you really love the show, you can help us out by going over to our website, again, to foodiepharmacology.com, and buying me a coffee. I could use some extra caffeine in my life, and each coffee you buy on the Buy Me a Coffee link helps to support production costs of the show. Thanks so much for listening. Stay healthy out there, and I'll see you next time.